and welcome to What Goes Up, a weekly markets podcast. My name is Mike Regan, and I'm a senior markets editor at Bloomberg. And this week on the show, well, I'm actually down at the Jersey Shore trying my best not to get sunburned and worsen my melanoma. So we actually recorded this podcast a week in advance, and therefore apologies to anyone who notices that our crazy things are a little out of date. But that's not the only thing different this week. Now, regular listeners will know that this show tends to focus on the old-fashioned investment assets like stocks and bonds and currencies. We don't dabble much into cryptocurrencies and decentralized finance investments, but I think we can all agree this newfangled stuff is just so fascinating that we'd all be foolish to ignore it completely. And recently, I wrote about really some fascinating developments in the DeFi space that kind of fall squarely into our wheelhouse here on this show. Equities, or at least synthetic equities trading on the blockchains without the ownership of any actual stocks being involved. So I'm happy to bring onto the show one of the innovators behind these tokens who was nice enough to answer, about a million questions I had for that story. And he's also brought with him one of his collaborators in the DeFi space. So let's meet them. Their names are Do Kwon, he's the co-founder and CEO of Terraform Labs, and Zaki Manian, he's the co-founder of Eclusion and the Sommelier Protocol. Do and Zaki, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for your time.
It's great to be here.
So, Do, I wanted to start with you. Now, I know you talk a lot about these projects and in in-depth sort of nuts and bolts of it. For our listeners, though, I was hoping you could kind of start with some of the basics, and especially the notion, two things that I think are really kind of at the center of these type of products. And one is the notion of just staking in the cryptocurrency and DeFi world, and also the notion of stable coins. And especially if you could start with staking, especially to me, I think what is fascinating in your project is how crypto can be staked as sort of a way to govern the protocol that runs everything. You know, you use them to vote or propose changes to the protocol. But walk us through, you know, kind of briefly the idea behind staking. You know, what are some of the motivations, some of the incentives to get people to stake their tokens, and especially that notion in their use in governing the actual Terraform, or rather Terra blockchain and the mirror protocol where these synthetic assets are trading?
Yeah, so the most general definition of the word staking means that you put your money at stake in order to make important decisions for the network. So like in most crypto networks, you have a token that can be used to govern the network or to set important decisions. And to stake the token means that you lock up these tokens in the blockchain. And then if you make a decision that is adversarial or counterproductive to the network, then you incur a penalty against that stake. You know, the good thing about this is that as the network grows, the amount of capital or the amount of tokens at stake increases as well. So you have this nice linearity with the growth of the network and the amount of money at stake.
And talk to us a little bit again, and I think this will be important for listeners who aren't familiar with this space to kind of understand what's coming next. But talk to us about stable coins. In other words, the idea that a cryptocurrency can basically track the dollar or another currency one-to-one as closely as possible. And the Terra stable coin, known as the Terra dollar, UST, being sort of the linchpin of many of these projects on your platform. Give us a little, sort of freshman level education on stable coins.
Yeah, so stable coins are cryptocurrencies similar to Bitcoin or Ethereum. But the key difference is that they're designed to track the price of something that's a little bit more stable, like the US dollar, like the Korean won, the Hong Kong dollar. And the idea is that if you have cryptocurrencies that are pegged to stable assets, then you retain all the benefits of Bitcoin and Ethereum, like permissionlessness. You can build apps on top of it. It's easier to cross borders. While at the same time, you have a token whose value tracks the price of something that you can use for actual currencies. So it's easier to weave into things like fintech and other types of applications.
Right. Now, so with the mirror protocol, and correct me if I get any of this wrong, but basically say I want to create a synthetic stock to trade on the Mirror protocol. So I will stake some UST, or no, it's actually the Mirror token, I guess, the Mirror protocol token, which is not a stable coin that fluctuates in value. I will stake some and suggest to the community, okay, I want, let's say Walmart. I want a synthetic Walmart stock to trade. So I'll put up a certain amount of the Mirror token, and then everyone else votes with their tokens, right? To decide whether, yeah, we do want a synthetic Walmart. Is that's the gist of it, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Right. And then so as a kind of a trader or participate in this network, I'll then say, okay, someone needs to create the Walmart token. So I'll put up some collateral to create a certain number of synthetic shares of Walmart. And walk us through what happens next.
Sure. So, you know, anybody can lock up some collateral. Let's say it could be Terra USD. It could be another cryptocurrency. It could be, you know, a derivative, a cryptocurrency derivative. So anyways, you lock up some type of crypto token whose value exceeds the amount of the synthetic that you're about to issue. So for example, if you lock up $150 worth of some collateral, you get to mint, you know, let's say $100 worth of some token that tracks the price of whatever has been just listed, let's say Walmart. So in that case, you can trade these synthetics, you can hold them, you can do whatever you want. But the idea is that you have this, you know, purely decentralized peer-to-peer exchange of value between many participants across the world globally.
Right. And how many do you suppose it is? I've seen some estimates. It's a few thousand regular traders, right?
Yeah. So it actually fluctuates quite a bit. So in crypto, usership really changes depending on how well the price of cryptocurrencies are doing. So these days we're seeing about, you know, anywhere between 3,000 to 6,000 daily active users, you know, like, but during, let's say, February, March, you know, sort of peak markets in crypto, we were seeing about, I don't remember the daily, but on a monthly basis, we were seeing about 150,000 monthly active.
150,000 monthly active. That's amazing. That's in a pretty short time, right? I mean, this all launched, what, sort of the end of last year?
Right. And a lot of it was, you know, purely by accident. So, you know, around the time when we first launched Mirror, Wall Street Bets was making like a big, was making big waves. And then, you know, the community, you know, tried to vote in things like GME and AMC, which were really popular assets in the Wall Street Bets movement.
Yeah.
And then a bunch of Twitter celebrities that were following that movement started to talk about Mirror as like an alternative to Robinhood that can't be censored, is entirely transparent. And I think that was probably the catalyst that led Mirror to take off.
I think what it all adds up to is, there must be traders around the world salivating at this stuff. Especially sort of your algorithmic based traders writing programs. One thing I find fascinating is you pull in from what's called an oracle prices of the actual stocks in the market about every 30 seconds. So for one of these sort of low latency, you know, trade on the microsecond type of algorithmic trader, that this has got to be a very appealing, I would think, opportunity for people like that. Are you finding that sort of participant yet? You know, really automated traders, not exactly just people sitting there trading by hand.
I think that there's a very interesting, you know, the confluence of having these trading platforms that exist only on chain has created like real opportunities to sort of interweave the consensus process and the trading process is the same sort of core infrastructure. And so you're seeing a lot of innovation there among trading firms as they try and figure out how all these pieces fit together. I think that there's a lot of, you know, we've never really had like open markets where the matchmaking function was transparent and open like this. And so what does it mean to be close to the market is very different in a decentralized world than it is in the old centralized world where it was all about, you know, there is an, you know, NASDAQ has a data center somewhere and it's all about being as close as possible to it.
Right. And I should point out, due to the nature of this type of project, you really don't know who's trading what. It's all anonymous, more or less, right?
That's right.
Kind of brings us to some of the issues covered in the story. In that, you got to wonder how regulators, the equity market around the world is so tightly regulated. Every year, it seems like there's a few hundred more pages of regulations added to the national market system in the U.S., for example, or the rules governing broker dealers. You must wonder how, do you feel like a shoe is going to drop from regulators eventually on this?
Well, so I sort of think about, these DeFi protocols as no different from the protocols that govern the internet, right? So in the beginning, when things like email or like Telegram or encrypted phones first came out, the regulatory response is always, add a backdoor, or, these protocols are bad for the economy, or whatever it is that
there's always a backlash at the beginning, I guess.
Yeah, but I think what's important is that what can be regulated and what can be governed. It's just basically these protocols change the natural law of how human beings interact with each other, right? And at the end of the day, if it's sort of like a decentralized shift in natural laws, the regulators find a way to work around it. So, for example, when email and Telegram and those things came out, these are still challenges that regulators overcome, but they've adopted other ways to make sure that regulatory enforcement is still possible, right? So for these decentralized protocols, even if you can't prevent these protocols from existing, which really can't be done, right? What they can do is to sort of try to regulate the vendors that interact with these protocols, and I think it's very possible to be able to do that.
Yeah. So I just want to comment on this a little bit, which is that I break it into three things. So I think the one theme is what Doe is talking about, which is what we've essentially done is made DeFi an inherent property of the internet. Like, if you're going to have the internet, you're going to have DeFi. And it's really hard at this point to have one without the other. So that's one aspect of it. The second aspect of it is there's the regulation, but then there's the aims of the regulation. And the aims of the regulation is to have fair, transparent, effective markets and effective price discovery and effective finance to run a society on top of. And I think blockchain protocols have done a really good job of starting to incorporate those things directly into the software. And I think the extent to which regulators are fighting DeFi while not embracing our ability to put these things directly in software, they're giving up a huge opportunity to make the world a better place. And then I think the last thing is composability. I think the most exciting thing about, why would you bring equities to DeFi? What's the point? The point is that, these protocols are composable in ways that, traditional equities are not. That you can't build, software that on top of your Robinhood account the way you can build software on top of your Mirror assets. And that's really, I think, a big piece of this that's very exciting. Why, again, this is important, and why I think it is a mistake to move too quickly into regulation.
So you made the point in some of the comments to me, and Zach, maybe you have some thoughts on this about how, not everyone's able to trade the stock market for whatever reason, whether you're in a country that has some kind of controls that will not let you open a brokerage account or it's prohibitively expensive. Talk to me a little bit about that notion. Who are some of the people who are kind of locked out from traditional stock markets that could benefit from this type of program?
Yeah, so it's kind of, hard to imagine this in the West, but, I think the equities market in some countries are more exciting than others, right? So, for example, the U.S. stock market is appealing. The U.S. companies lead industries in lots of different sectors, and therefore their equities are really compelling. But there are lots of places where it's difficult to gain access to asset classes that are outside of the country. So, or in some cases, there are adversarial rules and roadblocks that are set up to make it difficult to invest. So, for example, you know, in Korea and Japan, you know, capital gains tax on foreign equity single stocks is 26%.
Wow.
Whereas, you know, on domestic equities, it's like 0.2%. So, and then whenever, you know, retail interest in investing in foreign equities goes up, they make an announcement saying, hey, if you guys keep investing in U.S. equities, we'll just keep raising taxes, right? So they're purposefully designed to prevent capital flight and to keep as much money in domestic equities markets as possible. Or there are places like, let's say, China or Malaysia, where it's just in general very difficult to get access to equities outside of the country. So what's, you know, at like a surface level, like the very simple problem that these synthetic equities solve is that it allows global access to any asset class that is determined by the community. And that alone is really exciting.
Right. And I think that's an important point. I mean, we're talking about mirrored equities because that's kind of the first iteration of this. There's some mirrored ETFs too. What else, you know, could we, obviously, I guess you could probably try to do anything, right? Mirrored commodities and oil and gold and all that. I mean, is that something you think is coming in the pipeline?
Anything fungible that trades in a market can be made into a mirrored asset.
You know, to me, I'll admit it to you guys. I'm a worrywart at heart. You know, I'm always worried about what could possibly go wrong. So when I look at this, one of the things I worry about is stablecoins itself. You know, maybe you guys can explain a little bit about this. There's, you know, two ways to do a stablecoin. You do a Tether type of thing where you're actually, you know, backing the stablecoin with U.S. dollars, or, you know, I'm guessing there's other, you know, currency backed stablecoins out there. Or you can do it algorithmically, which I understand is what UST does. Can you give us, and, you know, with the acknowledgement that we're not all computer scientists out here, but can you give us an idea of how that algorithmic backing of a stablecoin works?
So basically the idea is that without having explicit collateral, you can set up a set of incentives to make it attractive for players to, you know, keep the price of the stablecoin at peg. So for example, in the Terra system, you have two levers that you pull, essentially like akin to, you know, monetary policies of central banks. And the idea is that at any given time, you can trade in $1 worth of Terra USD for $1 worth of Luna. So for example, if Terra USD is trading at 90 cents, you can buy from the market, you know, trade it for $1 worth of Luna and sell that and capture a 10% arbitrage. So whenever Terra is trading at a discount, market participants have an incentive to keep buying up the asset until it's trading at parity with the peg. Vice versa, if it's trading at $1.1, users now have an incentive to buy a dollar's worth of Luna, swap that to one Terra USD, and then sell that to capture 10% arbitrage the other way.
So, Zaki, let's hear what you're up to these days. How do your projects fit in with Terra and what Doe is doing?
So, you know, I've been building a lot of the infrastructure that Terra uses for like the last 7 years. So a lot of the sort of core software infrastructure that Terra is built upon is built on top of a project called Cosmos. And so, like, you know, we've been working very closely with Terra and with Doe for many years as they've been building out on our ecosystem. I'm working on a project called Sommelier, which is very focused on this sort of unique role of liquidity providers. So one of the things that is like very cool about these new crypto DeFi markets is that anyone can be a market maker. It's not this elitist, but like we need better tools. And so what Sommelier is focused on doing is building better tools for market makers in markets like TerraSwap and Uniswap and all of these DeFi exchanges. And it was really focused on and sort of democratized access to being a market maker.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. TerraSwap and Uniswap are sort of a different, a vastly different sort of model than your Coinbase or your Binance. What do you guys could walk us through how a DeFi exchange like that works? I mean, I guess the ultimate goal is no middlemen at all, right? You just want users to be able to trade with each other, with just the blockchain serving as sort of the exchange itself. Is that it might be an oversimplified explanation, but is that basically it?
Okay. So there's a couple of things. So basically there's this idea called a constant function market maker, where there's a very simple, frequently a very simple algorithm that looks at the value of two reserves and computes a price, and then someone can swap through that reserve. So why do we want to have systems that have reserves rather than having systems that just match buyers and sellers and converge on a price? Which is actually, we've tried over the history of cryptocurrencies and in this space. We've tried all kinds of different market architectures, but the one that has really taken off is this TerraSwap, Uniswap, constant function market maker with this reserve. And the reserve is provided by liquidity providers, which is who Sommelier is trying to serve. And why is this so powerful? Is it's actually really quite powerful in terms of this composability feature to be able to know that there is going to be liquidity at any price. At any time, at any price, being able to access liquidity and swap on it, like in a block, and sometimes compose a loan, a swap, something else into a single block, so that it all happens atomically. Like, imagine if you could literally take out a lock on the New York Stock Exchange. Say I'm going to sell stock, use that the cash from that to take a leverage position in another asset, and maybe look at the price change there, and then sell that asset, and no one else could trade at the time. And cryptocurrencies allow us to build stuff like that. And so this is why the Uniswap style, the sort of Uniswap style constant function market maker structure has taken a dominant position across the cryptocurrency world. And what this has, what the next implication of this is that this is all open source software. And so you just expect this functionality to be everywhere. Again, it just has a marketplace just becomes a function of the internet where you can basically swap any asset wherever you are at a click of a button and always know that you're going to be able to find a liquidity on the other side to take that position.
And so my understanding for the Mirror protocol is that there are trading fees associated, but they're all sort of recycled back into the community itself, that the liquidity providers, get a cut of fees and that sort of thing, which I think causes a lot of people to say, well, what's in it for Doe and Terraform Labs? And my understanding is that your other cryptocurrency, Luna, plays a role in all of this. Can you sort of walk us through sort of what your company and your personal incentives are for the success of Mirror?
Yeah. So, a lot of people think that we get indirect benefits from running Mirror. So there's no direct benefits, right? We don't take any trading fees. It's decentralized. There's no tokens that we pre-mine to ourselves. So ultimately, there's no direct incentive for doing it now. But, one of the benefits of having run Terra is that I'm pretty much 100% shareholder. There's no investors that hold equity in Terraform Labs. So you can be a little bit flexible of not everything that you do needs to be profitable, right? So we do a bunch of different things. For example, I founded a payments company that raised close to $100 million by SoftBank. So we work on, savings SDKs like Anchor and different things like that. So think about Mirror as one of those things that we did and a gift we gave to the world.
So, and just, to give it the, there's those old books, Staking for Dummies, or The Complete Idiot's Guide to Staking. So say I wanted to put something stupid in the Mirror protocol, like tokenized baseball cards or I don't know, whatever. And so I would put up a certain amount of MIR token and say, let's vote on this. Here's X number of Mirror tokens, MIR tokens. And everyone else who wants to, I guess, or can vote, and they stake their tokens as well, right? So if they say that's a bad idea and it gets voted down, then I lose the stake I put up. And does everyone who voted get back their tokens then?
Yes.
So guys, if I'm going to play devil's advocate for a bit and say mirrored equities, these are going to just be a plaything of insider traders, tax dodgers, money launderers, on and on and on. How do you respond to that?
I think, for tax dodgers and insider traders, if you're going to be doing insider trading, putting the record of that on a public ledger that is viewable in perpetuity is the worst idea ever.
Fair enough.
Yeah. So, generally, as you know, analytic systems for blockchains improve, it's actually like if you're trying to do something that is against the law, it's actually against your interest to put it on the blockchain,
right?
Because it never goes away.
Yeah. Right. So while the traders are anonymous, someone with a badge and a gun who wants to find out who they are will be able to, I guess, is the bottom line.
Right. Yeah.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
All right. Great conversation, guys. I got to tell you, though, we have a tradition on this show where we each take turns discussing the craziest thing we saw in markets this week. So I have a feeling in the DeFi space, you guys have seen some crazy things. Anything stand out, Do and Zaki? Any crazy things you've witnessed recently?
I would say the most interesting thing that has been happening is just like, to me, is like the acceleration of the liquid staking space. So I think Do commented on it briefly. And there's a project that we both collaborate on called Lido that makes sort of what are called staking derivatives. So derivatives from your staked asset. And these things have just exploded. Like 0.5% of all ETH is now in staking derivative form.
Wow.
Which is just mind boggling.
That is pretty mind boggling. How about you, Do? Have you seen anything crazy this week?
No, markets are pretty boring in crypto right now. And if they're not mirrored, I don't trade stocks. So,
yeah. Well, I was going to say, maybe the craziest thing is that it seems like the volatility has calmed down. You know, at least, I'm looking at Bitcoin. It's kind of been stuck in this range. You know, I don't know. What do you guys think? Is the volatility bound to erupt again there? Or is this kind of a new normal for Bitcoin and the other big cryptos to kind of be sort of boring?
Oh no. I mean, like as I've been doing this for 6 years, like the volatility is our friend, and I never think he's gone for long, and he's always welcome back to the house for dinner.
Just when you thought it was safe to go back in the water, you know, it's found to come back like the, you know, Jason in those old Halloween movies. All right. Well, I got a crazy thing, and it's tailored to you two guys because I want to sort of bring you into the conversation on it. It's a Bloomberg story about sort of all the scams going on in the crypto world. And I love, you know, I'm a novice to all this stuff, so I'm just learning of the term rug pull and getting rugged, which I find to be just a hilarious concept, a hilarious term, and honeypots. And we had this big, long feature story about some of these big scams and this site out there called Token Sniffer, which I guess is an attempt to try to weed out the real scams in crypto. You know, they have a name that I probably can't say on a family podcast. It starts with an S, rhymes with Bitcoin, and you guys know what I'm talking about.
Right.
But to me, you know, it's got to be frustrating to guys like you. Like, here you guys are, and I don't want to make you blush, I don't want to flatter you, but two guys who are obviously super smart. You know, Do, you went to Stanford, you've got a resume that includes time at Microsoft. I mean, you know, you're in this for legitimate purposes, but, you know, all around you guys, are, you know, for every Do and Zaki out there doing innovative, real world stuff, there's a million scam artists. And I just wonder, it must be frustrating. And is it in some way a headwind to what you're trying to accomplish? and to greater adoption of the projects that you're working on?
I'll say this though. I spend all of my time thinking about security, like how these protocols will survive in the most adverse, in the worst of circumstances. You know, you spend 99% of your time preparing for the worst. And if there were no adversaries out there, if there were no scams, if there were no, we wouldn't actually really know if any of this stuff works. So, you know, I do a little bit embrace the adversarial nature of crypto, the fact, and, you know, you just assume that every message that you get in your Telegram, every email you get, somebody's probably trying to trick you for some reason. it's not the worst way to live.
How about you, though? How do you react to all this? I mean, I guess part of it is, you know, I know you do a lot of podcasts, you do a lot of interviews. Is that part of it, just getting yourself out there and explaining your story and what you're doing and trying to educate people that way?
Yeah. I think a large part of what makes these protocols tick is sort of like a common philosophy that stitches people from diverse backgrounds together. And then in order to have that sort of connective tissue, you need sort of a common vision and a common story that people can believe in. And the best way to be doing that, for better or for worse, is the podcast circuit. So, which is why I do this. In terms of scams, though, I think what's interesting is that in 2017, there were no, you know, projects that were being used. So in some cases, like, you know, distinguishing the scams, if you will, from the non-scams was not possible because none of them had any users in the first place. So the only real difference was the founder's intentions, which is not possible to decipher against the decentralized protocol. So that was really hard. But today, that's kind of different. So if you look at, you know, some of the top assets in, you know, CoinMarketCap, the market is still inefficient. There are still lots of garbage in the CMC top 100. But I would say that's sort of changing as the more useful assets are sort of bubbling up to the top, whereas assets that are not useful are falling down.
Yeah, I guess there's a bit of, you know, Darwinism to it. You know, the strong ones will rise to the top and the rest will, you know, people will grow bored of, or, you know, the sort of eye popping, you know, one day gains that you see will stop being as frequent, I suppose. I don't know. Who knows, really?
Right.
Well, guys,
I'll just say I've been expecting the Dogecoin story to like come to an end for forever. And it just like never ends.
Yeah, how do you explain that, Zaki? I mean, is it, you know, to me, it's just, it's almost like the humor value of it, the meme value of it, is just enough to draw so many people into it, regardless of the sort of the fundamental story behind it. I mean, what's your take on that?
I have a very succinct take on it, so it won't take very long. The thing about the assets that Doe and I work on is, the narratives are complex. There's substance. There's real work on computer science and cryptography and stuff like that that's behind this. And as a result, if you want to hold those assets, participate in those communities, like you have to sort of become part of that narrative. And the barrier to that is very high. And the substancelessness of Doge and its sort of compatriots is a real asset for building sort of a meme-driven community, because there is no narrative, there is no like big idea, there's nothing to it, and so then it really is open to everyone. And so like the sort of Dadaism of these cryptocurrency of this kind of asset, I sort of started to figure out why it works, and it seems like it doesn't make sense in the very long term, but you know, for a community-driven thing, just like having zero substance whatsoever has become something of an asset.
Empty calories, like junk food, I guess, is always going to be appealing. Well, guys, I really appreciate your time. I think that's all the time we have for this. Doe, I know you're in South Korea. I know you got up early for this, so I appreciate that. Zaki, I'm not even sure where you are, but
I'm Palo Alto.
Oh, Palo Alto. Okay. So, the wonders of Zoom, we can all meet up from all corners of the world like this. And guys, really appreciate it. And, you know, anything new and exciting comes along in your space, let me know. And maybe we can do it again.
Yeah, thank you.
Sounds great.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Reganonymous. You can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. Thank you to Charlie Pelt of Bloomberg Radio and the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Topher Forges. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.